Anybody have a comment on this? Anyone? Bueller? Come on. Nobody? Yeah, please. No, I'm talking about reaching out to mathematicians. Yeah. I'm a biologist. Does entropy does not work for mathematicians or physicists more? Yeah. Okay. Well, anyway, this is just a little rumination.
I like Rita's comment saying that, you know, whatever you say you believe, we mathematicians believe what the body say, so you better be careful.
Okay. Well, I think that you can believe me when I say that there's an opportunity for math. Yes, yeah, John Tyson pointed that out, yeah. Oh, okay.
And entropy also can be viewed from very various angles. Could be evolutionary entropy,
The problem, I think a big problem for this is the different time scales, and in particular the role evolution plays, that we don't understand that very well. All right, well, thank you for indulging me. So this is actually a figure from a paper written by Vito and Sandy Anderson. And the goal of the groups that I work with is that we aim to develop quantitative models of how cancer cells respond to clinically relevant genotoxic stress. And when I say genotoxic stress, what I mean is clinically relevant treatments such as doxorubicin, ionizing radiation, cisplatin, etc. But the cancer itself exists in this very complicated environment where you have all sorts of extracellular signals coming in and perturbing these information processing cells. So you can have the inflammatory response, you have angiogenesis, we've seen a lot of really nice stuff about that. And how do we understand, given this complicated environment, given the milieu of cues coming in, how do we understand how to optimize the treatments such as the previous speaker called for? And what's emerged in the last few years is this idea of systems biology, and I just wanted to position our work in the spectrum of systems biology. So experimental systems biology, in a sense, has two limits. One is you have all the people that are running around trying to find the new nodes, and then you have other people that are trying to quantify the edges. And so the node, so then we have, you know, the hairball, which is composed of the nodes connected by the edges. And computational cell biology actually seeks to create quantitative predictive models of these networks, and there's many different flavors of computational biology. So there's more specific, these are the differential equations that we've seen talked about today, and then there's more abstracted, where you can actually just have large data sets and then mine those data sets for valuable information. And then the third axis I'd like to propose is that modern biology consists of both discovery science and hypothesis-driven research. And so hypothesis-driven research is what's driven the success of molecular biology for the last 50 years. And then discovery science has emerged in the last 10 to 15 years, where the ability of high-throughput methods allows us to look and see, just ask the question in a comprehensive way, well, what is the cell doing? And the space that we're trying to occupy is, as we would argue, is at the center. And I would argue that it's at the center where you have the greatest chance of generating new biology. And so if we look at sort of at this end of the axis where we have more abstract modeling, we're doing the discovery science, and we're finding the new nodes, this is the omics, right? So this is the proteomics, this is the genomics, this is the transcriptomics. And as Tak Mak pointed out, it's easy to criticize this as a bit of listology. So when you see these huge papers, you digest the vast amount of information, and yet as a biologist you're left wanting because you're curious about the mechanism. Alternatively, if we look at the other end of the spectrum, where we can because we can only measure in detail a few edges at a time, and when I say edges, what I mean is actual interactions, the dynamics of these interactions, the strength of those interactions. We can only measure a few of those at a time. This tends to be very at the far end of the reductionist scale, and we have very detailed models. And so then when we do this, we tend to look at smaller models, and we've seen a large number of people in physics and electrical engineering move into bacterial chemotaxis and study these toy models, and with some very notable exceptions. Again, this can be sort of unsatisfying because, in a sense, the biology has been driven out. And so we're trying to occupy this center ground where we utilize all of these different things and we actually can generate new biology. And when I say new biology, I mean we understand new mechanism, we understand new processes, new biological processes. And so what we're interested in is actually understanding how the various tumorigenesis barriers break down to yield a cancer cell. So you can imagine that you have a growing cell and that it acquires, perhaps due to environment, perhaps due to genetics, it acquires some percentage acquires a mutation. And so there's a number of systems in the cell to prevent this mutated cell from then growing into becoming cancer. And a lot of these, it turns out, are mediated by the DNA damage response. And the DNA damage response, so consider a situation where you have a precancerous lesion that actually ends up leading to oncogene induction, which then leads to an inappropriate amount of proliferation. And so this leads to replication stress, which can cause DNA damage, which activates the DNA damage response, and then you get apoptosis, which is cell suicide, and so this aberrant cell is cleared. Alternatively, you get senescence, which is a permanent cell cycle arrest, in which case, again, you're not growing a tumor. And so these are referred to as a tumorigenesis barrier. And then what I'm going to talk about today is that you can actually induce apoptosis and senescence by using these genotoxic cancer therapies. And so what makes a cancer cell is that it loses its ability to hear the screaming DNA damage response, and then it goes on and becomes a malignant tumor. And it turns out that you can, if you hit a tumor hard enough, you can actually stimulate these responses and induce apoptosis and senescence. And so that's what I'm going to talk about. And this is, you know, this is what causes the clinical efficacy of things like doxorubicin and cisplatin. All right. The mathematics that we use is very simple. We use basic regression analyses, like principal component analysis and partial least squares regression, in order to extract out from dynamic data sets situations where you have covariance. And this covariance in these data sets we interpret as a biological hypothesis. So here we have a situation we've treated the cells with a series of treatments, and we collect signals as a function of time on a number of different biologically relevant signaling molecules. And so we create this signaling matrix. So we can then plot this signaling matrix not as a simple function of protein function as a function of time, but we can actually create this multivariate data set where on each axis we have a different one of our signals. And then that actually creates a trajectory in this multivariate space where we can proceed through time to where the trajectory of the cell through this state space. And so what we can do is then we can use principal component analysis to reduce the complexity of this data set and identify the variables that covary. And so we start off with data. We then try to capture covariance, and then that establishes an initial axis. And so that's our first principal component. We calculate the residual. We then can calculate. What's on? Oh. Is that better? No. Maybe you could just hit the button. It says low bat.
Low battery.
So the point is that when we get these principal components, These components actually represent, we interpret these components as potentially correlated with biologically relevant processes. Okay. And so the actual math, we use partial least squares regression where we can actually regress two data sets against each other where we have a signaling matrix and then we have a response matrix. And we're specifically asking which of the signaling events co-vary with the various outcomes. And then this lets us, this generates a hypothesis that a given signaling molecule is in fact responsible for this cellular outcome. So we're actually trying to quantify the relationship between the information processing that's happening inside the cell and then what the cell ends up doing. Okay. And what I want to tell you about is this senescence phenotype. And so senescence is this permanent cell cycle arrest. Oh, battery. Actually, gonna sort of zip right along a little bit, actually. So the way we do these experiments is that we have identified a series of treatments, either untreated, a low dose of doxorubicin, this is 2 micromolar doxorubicin, for it's a pulse for 4 hours, and then we have 10 micromolar doxorubicin. And then we do a series of assays, whether they're Western blots, kinase assays, flow cytometry, or immunofluorescence, to monitor both the cellular responses and the cellular signaling. So the first step is actually quantifying cellular responses. And so we do this by monitoring apoptosis by flow cytometry. On this axis, we have cleaved caspase 3. On this axis, we have cleaved PARP. Cells that are double positive for these are in the process of apoptosis. In addition, we can measure viability by a series of other assays. And so what we see is that the low treated in the blue squares, we have no apoptosis. The blue diamonds. The red squares is 2 micromolar dox, and we have a little apoptosis, but then the apoptosis plateaus. But the higher doses, we get a lot of apoptosis. And it turns out that the 2 micromolar dose actually generates a G2 arrest. So that's shown here in the green triangles. So when we treat, interestingly, the cells wait about a day. But then after a day after treatment, they actually commit to this cell cycle arrest in G2. And any of the doses of doxorubicin that we use immediately obliterate mitosis. And that's shown here where we're actually measuring the percent of mitotic cells using phosphohistone H3 as a marker. All right, I'm going to move along, actually, because I'm a little low on time. But the point that I wanted to make was 2 micromolar doxorubicin induces senescence, and so here we have untreated cells. Here we have treated cells, and we see that there's a change in morphology. Nuclei get larger, cells get large and stringy, but significantly the cells have not all died, whereas with 10 micromolar doxorubicin, the cells all die, and particularly if we take the time course out to 4 days. And so we found conditions that establish these two different cell fates. And what we're interested in then are what are the signaling events that yield these two different cell fates. And so what's shown here is I've broken the cell down into four different modules, really. One is the cell cycle machinery. One is the DNA damage response. Another is the apoptotic machinery. And then we have the stress and mitogen activated protein kinases. And sort of central to all of this is P53. And we use a number of different methods to monitor the signal processing as a function of time after the DNA damage. So we use Western blots as indicated by a W. We use immunofluorescence as indicated by microscopy, kinase assay, and then flow cytometry. And so the idea, if you recall, is we're trying to generate a signaling data set. I've shown you how we collect a response data set, and we want to find the mathematical relationship between those two. Something that I want to point out is that we're doing a coarse-grained measurement of what's going on in the cell. So here is just a small sampling of the numerous signal transduction pathways in a cell, and we're not monitoring every node in that pathway. We're monitoring select nodes that we feel are representative of how the cell processes information. And the way we do that is by immunofluorescence. And so we actually take immunofluorescence micrograph, and then we have to extract the data out of this. And the way we do that is we do, first of all, we segment this image into, we can draw a border around the cell cytoplasm, and then we can draw a border around the nucleus. This is actually a program called ImageRail, written by my friend and colleague Bjorn Millard. And then once we have identified these different regions, then it's just a matter of counting pixels. And so we can just say, okay, these pixels are up, these pixels are down, and then that's how we extract our signaling information. Significantly, and I think that this is a big change, is that we're now doing this on a cell-by-cell basis. And so we can actually see how populations of cells change, and in particular, how populations of cells change as a function of time. And the result is that you get data that, if you look at it minimally, ends up looking a lot like flow cytometry. So here's just an example where I have a number of different signaling molecules I'm looking at under a different number of different conditions. Along this axis is the signal intensity, and then along this axis we have the number of cells. And so what you don't actually see a number, so you see that there's actually distributions in here. And I have to admit, at this point in time, I'm not actually using this distribution data. And so this is actually a big opportunity to collaborate with people that are more savvy in terms of statistics, and so that we can actually try to look more directly at what's happening in these different subpopulations of cells. Okay. All right. So this is redundant. All right. And now the reason that the senescence is interesting to me is because, as I told you, senescence and apoptosis are a tumorigenesis barrier. The problem with senescence is, and so you can imagine a situation where you have a tissue, you hit with some sort of damaging agent. If you have a sufficiently high dose, you get apoptosis. If you have some sort of intermediate dose, you can end up with senescence, and then a low dose, you might end up with a mutated cell. Senescence, at first glance, you think is great because it's going to stop the tumor from growing. The problem is that it's been shown that these senescent cells actually start secreting a number of factors which can then strongly manipulate their microenvironments. And so it's entirely possible that a lot of the remission that we see, when the cancer comes back, is actually the result of having treated with damaging agents, and then you have cells that spur those to grow because senescent cells actually secrete all these growth factors. All right. And so the biology that I'm looking at is we have this situation where we have DNA damage, and when you apply the DNA damage, you can either get the transient response and repair, or you can get the apoptosis, which is not on this slide, or you can get the persistent DNA damage response, which then activates senescence, but it's also been shown that this persistence response also can drive this senescence-associated secretory phenotype that I described. So this is the secretion that I was talking about here. And in a perfect world, the secreted molecules would actually recruit the immune system, which would facilitate tumor clearance. And then the senescence yields to tumor suppression. So that's why it actually having senescence actually makes sense. The problem is that if you actually don't clear the tumor and you end up with this chronic situation, then you can get tumor promotion, and that's bad. All right. So that's the biology. I told you how we collected data. So now if we actually do the regression now, so we have our responses where we're looking at markers of the cell cycle or markers of apoptosis, and we're comparing that to actually, there's more signals than I have here, but we compare that to a set of signaling measurements, and we do the math, and we get out our principal components, and when you graph these, what you end up seeing, when you're graphing the loadings of these components, it was very interesting to me when I did this, because there's no guarantee that when you do this math, when you do this regression analysis, that you're going to get any components that have anything to do with biology. That's not guaranteed at all. And so it was actually quite a thrill when I ran this for the first time. And I have, so if you look at the blue is my untreated. And so for whatever reason, on principal component 2, blue was down here. And it was not anywhere on the other principal component axis. But then, interestingly, the senescence components were on the opposite side of this axis, so whereas this has a negative value for component 2, these have positive values. And then In component one, the senescence and the apoptosis, they had different values. And so we can actually interpret this biologically, that component one, the x-axis, this is an apoptosis or a senescence outcome. And then on the y-axis, which is the opposite, so neither of these are proliferating, these guys are proliferating. So now component two, we can interpret the biology that this is a proliferation axis. And then if we look at the signals underlying these things, we can actually ask, well, which signaling events correspond to these outcomes? And it turns out that if you look over here, you see that, so P21, which I didn't talk about in sufficient detail, P21 is my major marker of senescence. As you remember from John Tyson's talk, P21 is responsible for a stable cell cycle arrest. And so what correlates with P21? Well, it turns out that this kinase ERK and this kinase JUNK actually correlate with P21. And then if you look at the apoptosis side, it turns out that phosphorylation of HSP27, which is actually a marker of P38 and MK2 activity. So what this has done, and so what we, by collecting a supervised data set, so we had a list of candidates. We weren't just looking at every molecule in the cell. We had targeted candidates for these are the proteins of interest. Because remember, it's hard to do a lot of protein measurements. It's more easy to do this with say, microarrays. And certainly people use this type of analysis when they're doing microarrays. There's no reason not to. But we were looking right at the heart of the matter, at the signaling molecules, measuring the states of the phosphorylation of these molecules. And we seem to have, so what this has generated is a hypothesis that ERK and JUNK are participating in the senescent outcome, and that P38 would be involved in the apoptosis outcome. And these are the, to put this once.
I have a question about the proliferation axis.
Yeah.
So these are treated cells, right?
So this is everything. This is all of the data regressed at the same time. And so there's a dimensionality reduction process that happens.
But so the component 2 is part
of. Yeah.
And so, does that mean that
so what are the signals down here? Is that what you want to know?
So what, on the
left, yeah. These guys. They're proliferating.
They are proliferating.
Yes. Yeah, so I could flip this, maybe make it more aesthetically pleasing. But I thought they were mathematicians. I thought they would do the thing. It's up, it's down, you know.
Down is down.
Down is, what do you mean it's down? I thought you said they were proliferating. It's not fair. Okay. Okay, I don't want. This is redundant. Okay, I'm going to wrap this up so we can have a bit of a break. But this, so here we're actually going and looking at the data underlying what I was telling you. So here is the immunofluorescence, and so gamma H2AX. This is a marker of DNA damage. So in the untreated, there's no signal, and here we see lots of DNA damage in the nuclei of the 2 micromolar doxorubicin treated cells. Phospho-junk, again, in the untreated, there's no signal, but 4 days later, we see lots of phospho-junk in the nuclei. And then June, which is downstream of junk, likewise gets upregulated here. And so I'm sort of closing the loop. So I said, collect this data set in a supervised way, unsupervised regression, you generate this hypothesis, but let's go check the basic data. So the basic data actually fits. This is the data underlying the modeling. This fits what we think is going on. And that immediately reminded me of the fact that recently, as in April, so I guess it's not so recent anymore, but April of last year, people actually showed that junk is recruited to gamma H2AX at the sites of DNA damage. And that people then sort of assumed that junk actually would then, the recruitment of junk to the sites of damage was involved in whether or not cells apoptosed. And what my result says is that it's a little bit more complicated because this, the role of this junk could be in either apoptosis or senescence. And so actually, and if you look at some of my basic data, this isn't very high resolution immunofluorescence, but you actually can see that a number of the H2AX foci and a number of the junk foci actually co-localize. So I think that this jump, so I think, so what I'm saying is that this preliminary data suggests that junk does play a role in the response of these cells to DNA damage.
But this is more important than that, basically, because junk is normally a cytoplasmic protein, isn't that right?
Oh, yeah, right. It gets targeted. So what I'm showing is...
That's a unique feature. The fact that junk is being localized to DNA was not known before.
Well, no, it was shown by other people.
No, but I'm saying this, the fact...
It's not important. Yeah, right. So this is maybe the first functional example of that. Anyway, so the point is that this is actually more complicated than I want to get into. But the point that I want to make is, so then, because I'm a biologist, the way that I test to see if junk is actually doing something is I turn junk off. And so what I want to tell you is the fact that if I add a junk inhibitor, and this actually goes to the point that I made this morning, what a cell does is very much dependent on its context. And so if you add a junk inhibitor to cells that have seen no treatment, the result, and so what we're looking at here is BRDU incorporation into DNA, which is a marker of proliferation. So basically, if BRDU ends up in your nucleus, you're growing. And so if in untreated cells, if we add a junk inhibitor, we get less proliferation than if we did not add the junk inhibitor. And this is basically what John Tyson told us this morning, is that, you know, you have these growth factor signals coming in, they are processed by the cell in a certain way, they lead to phosphorylation of June, you get proliferation. Is that right, John? Yeah? Okay. And what I'm saying is that if you now do this in the context of DNA damage, what I've told you is that DNA damage rewires the cell. And so now, DNA damage, if you don't have the junk inhibitor and you have this amount of DNA damage, the cells do not replicate, right? Because they've senesced. They've entered this permanent state of cell cycle arrest. In this case, if you add the junk inhibitor, the cells can now escape from the DNA-damage-induced senescence, and you get proliferation. So I think this is actually potentially a relatively, this is a very strong example of rewiring a cell. In this context, junk is pro-proliferation without the DNA damage. With the DNA damage, the junk gets it going. All right. And so the point, so this is my last slide, except for my acknowledgement slide, which is just summarizes what I just said. So you have untreated situation, you have a DNA damage situation, here junk activity, no, that's backwards. No, it's not. Junk drives the arrest, and if we shut off junk, it goes the right way. Here junk drives proliferation. And I think where the application is in combination therapies. Because if you have a situation, and so actually your PD cisplatin experiment is fascinating because ERK is also, I use the PD drug and I see a similar effect that adding PD, and actually the PD drug and the junk inhibitor together, I get a huge amount of release from senescence. And especially perhaps with the levels of doxorubicin that you're getting into your cells, you're not necessarily going to get apoptosis. You're probably going to get a lot of senescence. And so it's possible that you could imagine here, the timing could be very important. So you could have a situation where you add your genotoxic agent, you induce senescence. Okay, but now with your senescent, now you're not susceptible to your genotoxic agent anymore. So now you come in, and you come in with your junk inhibitor, your ERK inhibitor, you release, you get cells proliferating again. And now you come in with your genotoxic agent again. And as you pointed out, you would want modeling to predict the dynamics to optimize when those therapies should be. So, thank you for your time. Thanks for letting me go over. Oh, sorry. Vito. Yes, sir.
So,
damage.
Yeah.
Heterogeneity.
Yep.
And how do you make sure that damage is
Right. And okay, I'm thrilled that you asked me that, because the way that I think about this is that you have a heterogeneous tumor. And so we want to think about combination therapies perhaps as the first treatment corrals the cell into a susceptible state. And then you could come in and hit it again. But it'll only be through an iterative process of maybe flipping the cell from state, flipping the cells from susceptible state to susceptible state. And so I, through this sort of understanding the information processing system, we can actually get to the point where we can engineer what state the tumor cell is and get and hit it. And so our enemy at the moment is heterogeneity, and how do we fight that? I think we can fight that intelligently with treatment.
So it would be an interactive process?
I think it would, yes. And so the talk yesterday about, you know, having the interaction between radiation therapy and then imaging was intellectually the same. And so that's why I asked my question about molecular readouts. It would be great if we could actually have, say, a molecular readout for when for senescence. So what if there was a surface marker, so we could drive them into, okay, and now we use our PET and say, okay, they're all senescent, hit them with a JNK inhibitor. That would be awesome. Yeah, Steve. Oh, that's the part I skipped. That's the part I skipped. You didn't miss it. I ran out of time. But I think, okay. So what I think is happening, and this is my bad way of showing feedback. So it's currently known that the senescence actually can, the senescence, the secretory, the things that are secreted, which are things like IL-6 and IL-8, they help enforce the cellular senescence. And it's understood, actually, that these molecules actually maintain the DNA damage signaling. And that the, but then it's also known that the DNA damage signaling drives the secretion of these molecules. This is how I think the cell maintains the arrest. This is how you have a permanent arrest, because what I think is happening is these things aren't causing damage, but these things are preventing the damage from being repaired. And what's not understood, and so you'd be like, people say, well, why do you want to keep the damage? Why do you want to keep the damage from being repaired? Well, that's the persistent DNA damage is what drives the cellular senescence. So in the senescence field, it's observed, you have gamma H2AX foci that last for weeks. Do I think that that DNA is completely unrepairable? I don't. I think that that DNA is being kept unrepaired to maintain the cell cycle arrest maintaining signaling machinery. Now what I think, so the question becomes, what is the molecular mechanism underlying this? Well, I think that junk is actually modifying the DNA damage response and preventing repair. I also think that junk is activating June, which is activating the senescence-associated secretory phenotype, which in turn is driving the DNA damage through here. So you have this loop where, because the problem with this model is they explain how junk is localized, but they never explain how junk is turned on, because you need to have those activating phosphorylations to actually turn on the junk. And so it's the classic chicken or the egg when you have a feedback system, but eventually you get the system going, and June turns on the secretion, which turns on the junk, which keeps the DNA damage off. The DNA damage off leads to the secretion, you know, and so you have a lot of feedback in this system. So the issue is, I'd rephrase your question, the issue is, how does the cell maintain this permanent arrest? Through keeping the checkpoints on by maintaining the damage. Is what I think. And I haven't proved that yet. Vito.
So, senescent cells get very long.
Yeah.
So my question is, is there any increasing biomass? And if so,
can we burn it? No.
Your toxins of metabolism.
So I have measured phospho-S6, but I haven't put it in the model. But I should do that. And yeah, especially, I mean, yesterday morning, I was just spellbound. It's like, oh my God, you know, metabolism. And it's not surprising, but yeah, that's a good question. I don't have an answer. Thank you.